Episode I'm going to talk about Open Indiana. I don't know how much you know about Solaris or Open Indiana for that matter, so I'm going to give you a quick little overview of its history, just in case you're not aware of some of the finer points. So there was this company called Sun Microsystems. It was huge. It was a cornerstone of technology. People thought it would never go away. It was always going to be here. It was always going to be a part of our lives. It is responsible for technology such as Java, kind of a big deal, ZFS, kind of a hot topic lately, NFS, really important still, and the Solaris operating system. Now, Solaris is noteworthy for many reasons, but one reason because the original AT&T Unix code that got born out of AT&T in the 70s was purchased, a license was purchased by Sun Microsystems such that they could develop a Unix operating system for themselves, and they did. It was called Solaris. The other notable license of Unix to have been distributed, of course, is the one that was given as a gift to the Berkeley University in California, and now provides the basis for the Berkeley Software Distribution, or BSD. Anyway, Sun has nothing to do with BSD. It was Solaris. It was the other Unix. And in 2009, Sun Microsystems, sort of to the shock and horror of everyone looking on, went out of business. They folded. They got bought specifically by Oracle, and Oracle acquired everything that that Sun Microsystems owned, including Solaris. Now, the future of Solaris is still uncertain. The pessimists among us might say that it's actually pretty much written in stone that it's going to die at the end of this support cycle. Other people are saying that it's just not 100% clear on what's going to happen. I think Oracle's official stance, last I heard, was that it's fine, everything's fine, in spite of the fact that they have laid off like practically the entire engineering team of Solaris, from what I've read online. I don't work there, I don't know what's going on. I can say what I witnessed as someone who was into the Linux and Unix scene at the time, and that was around 2007, maybe, Sun started ramping up their open source project initiatives. At least that's what I was observing. And I think a lot of other people were too, but most notably, certainly after Solaris 10, they suddenly open sourced the code base of their operating system. Now, that's no small feat. I mean, I still hear about projects today that supposedly can't open source their code because it's just too complex, too many contributors and such and such. So I'm no expert on licensing, but the fact that they just sort of turned around and said, okay, our operating system is now open source, that's a big deal. That's a huge statement. And it was very puzzling at the time. It was very exciting, but it was kind of startling. And they established this community around a project, and the project they dubbed Open Solaris. The codename was Indiana, I think, of the first release, if I recall correctly. And they brought in Ian Murdoch, who had started the Debian project. And my general impression, and I think other people's impression at the time, was that they were kind of taking notes from possibly, you know, RHEL and Fedora, sort of like, oh, this is RHEL, our server OS, and here's Fedora, our, quote, community project that also is our desktop edition. And I guess you could even argue that that's kind of the relationship, in a way, that Debian and Ubuntu have, so maybe they were taking notes from that as well, I don't know. But that was kind of my impression, that Solaris 10, or Solaris, was going to be the server distribution, and here's the company supporting a community edition that was friendlier for people at home, desktops, laptops. And I ran OpenSolaris on a couple of laptops whenever I decided to check in with the project, and I saw an OpenSolaris booth at the, I think it was the Ohio Linux Fest. Ian and a couple of other guys with the project were there at the booth. I got to speak with everyone, and they seemed genuinely sort of excited about the thing that they were doing, and there was such an air of mystery to it all, because on one hand you kind of felt, you know, there were people saying, "Oh, Ian Murdoch has sold out. He's not all about free software anymore. He's sold out to Sun Microsystems, and he's becoming this corporate person. And why is he doing this? And why are they trying to, you know, are they compete? They're trying to kill Linux." Other people were thinking, "Well, Sun is clearly taking on the role of building a community around Solaris and making it into something that more people than just Sun own." And now whether Sun wanted to do that, you know, actually make sure that their code was distributed because they believed in open source and so on, I mean, that's not a crazy idea. They've got open source stuff. I feel like their open source offerings increased towards the end. And I guess that's what I'm trying to imply here. I don't know whether someone high up at Sun saw what was coming, you know, like the end of Sun, and thought, we need to open source this because I love open source and it's the moral and just thing to do. Or whether they said, we need to open source this stuff because whoever ends up buying us, I don't want them to have everything to themselves. Or whether they were saying, we need to open source this because we've worked really hard on a bunch of technology and I would hate for it to die. I don't know what the rationale was, but at least in my impression, their open source friendliness increased the nearer to death that they got. This is all more or less hindsight. I mean, the minute they went out of business, it became a question, but certainly now that I'm looking back, it's even more of a question. And obviously I'll never know any of the answer to those things. Doesn't matter. Point is, 2009 rolls around and Sun does indeed go out of business. Oracle purchases them, and the OpenSolaris community is kind of left hanging. Oracle, if I recall correctly, and I couldn't find this online necessarily, I didn't look all that hard, but if I recall correctly, they made an announcement saying that OpenSolaris was not in danger. It was going to continue. It was going to be fine. There were no changes whatsoever. Sure. Now, after that initial announcement, there was a lot of silence, and it wasn't until around 2010, late 2010, that a couple of things happened. One, a project called Open Indiana was created. It was September 14th, which was a Tuesday of 2010, that they announced the distribution called Open Indiana, and it was billed as a distribution of OpenSolaris. Probably not coincidentally, right around the same time, Oracle themselves had issued an internal memo that, of course, got leaked online about how they were going to discontinue OpenSolaris in favor of something called Solaris 11 Express. And either way, it was all going to be developed internally rather than as a community project. And from the ashes, so to speak, of OpenSolaris, there arose two different distinct projects. One is called Illumos, and the other is Open Indiana. And for a long time, I wasn't even clear on how those two were separate from one another. And I'm not still entirely sure where one ends and where the other begins. But if you go to illumos.org, you'll get the feel for the kind of stuff that they manage, and if you go to Open Indiana, you'll get a feel for what they're doing. If I had to sort of paint it very broadly, I would say Illumos is doing kernel and really low-level maintenance, whereas Open Indiana and several other projects are acting as the distributions of the Illumos version of Unix. And that brings us to a couple of weekends ago when I sat down and kind of checked in as I do on a yearly basis, I guess. I checked in on illumos.org, openindiana.org, and triblix.org, and a couple of other sites that I like to just kind of see if they're still alive. And it turns out that that a couple of distributions of Illumos are still alive and kicking, one being Triblix.org, which I did not install simply because I wanted to go down the direct path of Open Indiana. Because that's the direct successor of Open Solaris. So I kind of felt like, yeah, let's see how it's doing. Let's see where it's gotten off to. So I installed it onto the internal hard drive of my laptop. I run Slackware on the sort of expansion bay hard drive on an SSD drive, and the internal drive on this particular HP EliteBook that I have. It was a used laptop, and it's quite small, and the internal drive is actually a non-standard size. It's something like 1.8 inches instead of 2.5. And it's really odd and difficult to replace, so I kind of didn't want to put too much stress on the internal drive, just because if it ever dies, it'll just be wasted space. So I run my daily OS off of the expansion bay, but I figured, well, not doing anything with that internal drive, I might as well try something on it. So I installed Open Indiana, and I didn't have to mess around with partitioning, which was nice, because the partition scheme was just, yes, use the entire drive. So that made things simpler. I don't know how simple it would have been if I'd had to partition. I mean, I don't know how simple it would not have been. It might have been really simple either way. But I'm just saying that the install went pretty quickly and pretty smoothly because I didn't have to worry too much about fancy hardware stuff. Hardware support, turns out, is pretty great. Now, this computer, as I say, is secondhand. I got on TradeMe, which is the local New Zealand version of eBay, and it does not have a functioning webcam. Like, the camera just does not, it doesn't work at all. And I'm assuming it's a wiring issue, but yeah, it just doesn't work under anything. It doesn't even show up as a hardware component. So that doesn't work. But everything else does, including the wireless card, which I think it's fair to say that's impressive. The process of installing was mostly GUI. You have to step through a couple of text prompts initially, and a lot of it is a little bit similar, I would say, to FreeBSD. And I don't remember the install of Open Solaris enough to remember how its installer was, but it does strike me as interesting that the bootloader that they're using on Open Indiana is the FreeBSD bootloader, not Grub, for instance. Now Triblix is using Grub, from what I understand. I haven't tried that yet, but it's using Grub, but this one actually uses the BSD bootloader, so that's kind of just something to note, really. Not important. Now, when you boot it up, it boots to a graphical, boots into X by default. So, again, I get that feeling that the target is at least a desktop enablement, you know? I mean, I realize that Solaris had a GUI as well. I just always find it interesting when something chooses to boot to a GUI. Although I guess that's what everyone's doing now, except Slackware, which is fine. But it sets the tone, at least for me, right or wrong, and I guess it could be wrong. But it boots to a GUI, and the GUI that it uses by default is the Mate or Mate desktop. I really don't know how to say that. I never say that aloud because I never actually use it, so I struggle now that I'm having to say it out loud. So the GNOME 2 fork, which Open Solaris had used GNOME 2, so for this to use the fork of GNOME 2 is very, very appropriate, and it kind of warmed my heart when I saw it, to be honest. I because it's just got this, it's got this look to it, and it's very sort of integrated into that classic Java UI that you'd know if you've ever used certainly any Java application on an actual Solaris box. is just like the classic look, and it's got that sort of look and feel to it, and it just looks so cool, so brilliant, and it's just so nice to see that theme returns for Open Indiana. A little thing, admittedly, but it was kind of nice. And it's funny to be so nostalgic about something that's only like 10 years old, but and really that only lasted for 2 years. I mean, if I'm talking about Open Solaris itself, it only really was alive for 2 years. Well, maybe a lot longer if people work at Sun, were probably, you know, working on that a lot longer than just the 2 years that I knew about it. But so it comes up, and it's got all the, you know, it's got the right icon theme, it's got the right window decorations, and it's using the right environment. And for me to say that this is the right environment is saying a lot, because I was never a fan of GNOME 2. No, I was not. I really don't care for GNOME 2. I'm glad that it's gone. And yet, because this is the Open Solaris experience that I initially had, this is the correct one for me, at least in the sense that I'm thinking that this is how it should look for Open Solaris. Everything on Open Solaris, as I recall, was a lot more foreign than it feels in Open Indiana. And I don't know if that's because I've just gotten used to Solaris, which doesn't really make sense because I haven't used Solaris since two jobs ago. So for me to have become more familiar with it now doesn't really make sense. Maybe I'm just getting more flexible with what I accept as Unix, I don't know, but it does feel like they've kind of expanded the scope almost of their user space. And again, this I could be wrong about this. I could be making this up, but I seem to recall having typed in something as simple as like SU on Open Solaris and it not working, and certainly sudo wasn't pre-installed. Again, I could be totally wrong about this, but that's my memory of it, and I could be mixing the memory up with the actual Solaris boxen that I had to use at work at one point. But I remember them not being there and having to learn about the command called pfexec. Again, could be completely making this memory up. It also has, and this is kind of unique, I think, I don't know, actually I haven't used Solaris in a while, but the Open Solaris version, I think, was the first one with the package command, pkg. And that's what this is using, pkg, and you can list software available, you can update software, you can install, remove, and so on. All from one interface. Seems like not a big deal, but if you'd use Solaris prior to Open Solaris, it made a huge difference, and it was one of the other contributing factors of me thinking that Open Solaris must somehow be Sun Microsystems' move into the desktop space, because this was just so, it was getting to be so easy to use. You know, it was like Fedora or Ubuntu. It had a package manager and it had all these familiar commands and everything. It was running a familiar desktop. Everything just seemed so Linuxy, I guess, and that was a big deal. It felt like a big deal anyway. And I don't remember. I think I was using Solaris 10 at one point, and I don't remember it being quite that easy to use either. So for a person who kind of was very used to Linux, so all of that felt very new, and it feels like it's been smoothed out even further here. Their repository offering, I'll admit, not exactly amazing, but it's there, and it's super easy to sort of get to. You know, you go there, and you can add repositories very easily. You can enable the ones that you want. So it's not over complex, which I don't remember the Open Solaris one being super easy to use. Then again, there weren't really that many repositories back then. It was CSW, BlastWave and CSW, I think, were the two that you kind of had choices between, and like that was really it, as far as I can recall. Interestingly, Open Indiana is also using Pulse. It ships with Pulse Audio, which to me, again, that's really surprising. That definitely wasn't in the original. Well, I shouldn't say definitely. I do not remember that being in the original at all. I have had some weird problems with the networking on this machine. I don't know if it's like a driver issue or if it's something that I just don't understand about my network setup. I mean, my network setup is not that complex, so I kind of feel like it shouldn't be on my end. But for instance, if I, like right now, it's just kind of flipped over, and it's obviously a DNS problem, because if I ping, for instance, google.com, it just hits back with unknown host. And then if I ping, for instance, 208.67.220.220, it pings that successfully. So it's very obviously a DNS problem, and I don't know what the problem would be. And I've looked at my settings, and it looks like everything's correct. The name servers are set. I can ping the name servers. So I'm not too sure what's happening with that. And it doesn't happen all the time. It's not consistent. It's been online for as long as I've been talking on this episode, and it's just kind of when I go to use the thing that it decides to flip over to not actually being able to get out onto the internet. And I feel like it's something to do with the way that it defines its network locations. And I'll have to do more research about that. That's a new problem. I mean, new meaning I never had any network problems on Open Solaris. And so it's new to Open Indiana. But then again, I mean, I've never installed... This is a fairly new laptop in my life. At least in terms of my experience with Solaris. So this is never... You know, I've got nothing to compare this to other than what it usually runs, which is Slackware. So anyway, that's a weird problem, and unfortunately I don't even know enough about my available commands to know how to probe my hardware on here. I've tried a couple of different commands that I imagine might be relevant, and none of them exist, so that's something I'll have to learn and explore later on. The distribution as it ships to you on an ISO or a bootable USB image, pretty trim. It's got, again, the Mate desktop and all the associated components of that, like the terminal, system monitor, cups, gparted for partitioning, the file manager, obviously, Firefox, Pigeon, Thunderbird, Tiger VNC, it's an image viewer, I think, and a couple of basic text editors, screenshot tool, and that's about it. Now, as I said, there's a package manager, so you can install more once you've gotten it installed. It's the package manager is called PKG. And the packaging system that it uses is the image packaging system. And I'm just learning about this myself in terms of how to actually create packages. So I'm not going to go through it in detail because I would not get it all right, I don't think, yet. But the idea is that there's the binary compiled application, and you put that into the package that you're going to distribute. And there's a little bit of a not a jail, but sort of a, or not a cheroot, like a destination directory for the things that you build, and it's for whatever reason called Proto, PROTO, all capitals. and you put everything into Proto, so all of your, you know, your little mini file system that is going to get distributed with your package goes into Proto, and then you create a package manifest, which lists everything that Proto contains in a file that can be audited by the system. You generate a file and directory listing, again, just based on whatever is in Proto at that moment. And then you generate package dependencies. Now, IPS itself, the image packaging system itself, includes the ability to scan the contents of the Proto directory and figure out what dependencies exist. Now, I haven't used it yet, I haven't yet made a package as of this recording, but for Open Solera, Open Indiana. But I love this feature. If it's as cool as it sounds from the documentation, I'm really excited about it. I mean, there's LDD, and you can look at things that you're packaging and make sure that you know there are no surprises, that you see that everything that you think is required is listed. But there's just something about like the packaging system itself knowing somehow, and I don't know how it knows because I haven't really looked into it all that much, what your package is likely to depend on seems really, really useful. So that's cool, and I'm excited to actually get to try that at some point. And then you can publish your package. You can, you know, package it up, put it on a repo, whether it belongs to you or whether it's something that you're contributing to, and then people can use your distribution, your packaged application. It's kind of cool. I'm excited about trying it. I don't know how far I'll get with it. It might turn out to be either too much trouble for me to bother with, or just, I guess, too time consuming, which I guess is the same thing as too much trouble. But yeah, I mean, I would definitely like to make a package for Open Indiana and just to see how that is done and what I think of it, really, what I think of the actual format itself, because I'm always interested in how POSIX systems distribute applications. I think that's a very interesting thing to take into account. So one of my problems with FreeBSD when I installed it on my laptop prior to installing Open Indiana was a distinct lack of file system support. I couldn't get any of my favorite journaled file systems to work on FreeBSD. I could get certain things to work without the journaling, but I couldn't get the things to work with journaling. So that was kind of a deal breaker for me, to be honest. As I've explained in previous episodes, all of my actual data, the data that matters to me, is on a thumb drive that I back up to the computer. So if I'm plugging it into an OS and it can't maintain or repair or use the journal, then that's kind of useless to me. So the fact that Open Indiana has support for JFS is perfect for me. That's kind of all I need. Now, I don't know anything about the support for a UDEV-like system. I don't know how to make Open Indiana back up my thumb drive, in other words, whenever I plug my thumb drive into it. But the fact that it will support a journaled file system on a removable thumb drive is a key component for me. That's a really, really important thing. And it's kind of funny how the server-based operating systems just really, it's really an odd, weird sort of blind spot that they have, I think, for those file systems or removable drives at all. I mean, even Linux, in a way, if you want to talk about ease of use, I mean, Linux and removable hard drives, it's not exactly the best experience ever, because if you've got a removable hard drive and it's using a native POSIX file system, then there are permissions that are associated with that, and you really kind of have to go out of your way to overcome those permissions, really. You know, one way or the other, whether it means that you manage all of your users with the same UID and the same everything, or whether it's you use a sticky bit on the thumb drive to just absolutely make everything world readable and writable, or whatever you do, it's not as easy as something like UDF, the universal disk format, where you can just plug it in, doesn't care, it doesn't even see a partition, it just sees the UDF space that it puts your data onto. So for servers, it's even, I think, more of a problem, because they don't really expect you to be plugging in removable thumb drives, and certainly they don't expect you to be using thumb drives that contain your home directory, essentially. And who knows, maybe I'll give ZFS on a thumb drive a go, I don't know. I'm pretty sure I heard that that's not really its intended use, but you never know, could give it a go. That's everything I think I have about Open Indiana. I mean, it's not a whole lot, and I guess distro reviews typically boil down to the same thing, you know. Yes, the desktop looks nice, and here's the applications that come with your initial download, and here's what worked on my laptop, and here's what didn't. And that's kind of what I've told you about Open Indiana. But in terms of Open Indiana as a thing, it's a cool little project, right? It's any other distribution of any POSIX entity. It's cool. It boots, you do things, you figure out whether what you want to do will work on that or not, and you go forward from there. Simple. But I think in a broader scope, in the bigger picture, is that it is a continuation of Solaris, which, you know, I mean, I remember Solaris fondly as a quirky little thing that I encountered here and there. I have no real allegiance to it whatsoever. On the other hand, I recognize that it's a real Unix, that it has a history to it, and that it's got a pretty big market. Oracle said that 40% of its market, of its customer base, was Solaris-based, and when they bought Sun. So they said 40% of their customer base was 40% of their customer base was Solaris. And in their view, that meant there was a 60% opportunity to get people onto Solaris, right? I mean, that's in terms of sales. 40, we have 60% to fill with more Solaris, which is why they killed Open Solaris. So it's not a small or insignificant factor. It's a big deal in some space, and for Open Solaris to exist, I think, is in a weird way a shining example of the success of open source. Solaris could have died, it could have gone away, it could still go away, but for there to have been a liberation of that code base, I think is very, very cool. So in that sense, I'm cheering for the Open Solaris guys, Open Indiana and Illumos guys. Hope they keep going, and what they've got so far is really cool. So if you're looking for an alternative Unix to look at on a weekend or something to run on a spare box, check out Open Indiana. It's worth it. And now before I go, I want to talk a little bit about listener feedback, because, hey, I got some, and I waited to record this episode until I got listener feedback. Well, I mean, not consciously, it just kind of worked out that way. But this one is from Doug, who wrote me because he heard his name. So that means now that I've said his name again, I guess he's obligated to write again. So this is going to be a vicious cycle, but maybe he'll find a break out of that loop. So what he says is that not recently, but in the past, he's packaged up GUI applications for distribution, and it's always been quite the hassle. Getting a Windows application to run somewhere was always a pain, and I can't say that using Python was all that much easier, so many dependencies. Of course, it's been quite a few years since I've done it, so it could be much easier now. Some of the tools like Kivy, K-I-V-Y, don't even know what that is, and Beware, don't know what that is either, are attractive, especially for doing cross-platform GUI development with Python. I'll have to try them out to get a feel for them. Anything I write these days, aside from web applications, has a command line interface, which I use argparse, that's how I found about argparse, actually Doug told me about it, or the third-party library Qlik for. I try to make those nice so people, including myself, can use them without too much effort. And he says, web applications have a pretty big step up in complexity to develop. They need a server, usually some kind of REST API interface, a client-side JavaScript application, CSS, HTML, blah, blah, blah. And you're right, the browser isn't a completely open-source environment in which to deploy an application. It's kind of strange. It's kind of a strange mix. Like, Chrome isn't open-source, but the version 8 JavaScript engine is. Tools like jQuery, React, and Angular are open-source, but something like PyCharm, using PyCharm to develop, isn't. As a developer, I tend to be something of a control freak, and as such, I've been burned plenty in the past by users trying to install thick, gooey applications onto their computers, which I have no control over, trying to manage this and make sure all the dependencies are up to date, don't conflict with anything else on the machine, and that users or IT people aren't outright lying to me with what's being done. It can drive you insane. So all of that's very interesting. The last paragraph, though, I think is sort of most interesting. And it is. It's something about when you're developing an application. He says humbly that it's him being a control freak, but in a way it's almost his obligation, right? A developer, you kind of have to be a control freak, because otherwise, if you're not micromanaging the stuff that you're distributing with your code, then it may not work. You know, like if you just say, well, hey, here's my code base, you can install it, you know, this way. I hope that all of your library versions and application versions and so on match up with what I used when I was developing. And hopefully it'll all work out for you. And if you think about it, that's kind of crazy, really. It's kind of a crazy way to distribute software, which I guess is probably like why I like app image so much. Because with an app image, you can freeze a specific thing that you need your application to use and distribute it along with your application. So if you need a specific version of FFmpeg or whatever, then you can include that in your app image, and now you know that they are using the exact specific version that you developed for. And I use FFmpeg because that's one that will drive you absolutely crazy. They change so many of their command line options so frequently that there's just almost no way to keep up with it. And I've used FFmpeg in an application before. I am using FFmpeg in an application now, and yeah, it'll just randomly break. Just all of a sudden the export function breaks down, and you won't figure out why until you mess around with it and finally start getting the errors that you need, and you realize, oh, this iteration they want me to add a K after the bitrate, but the version before they didn't need that, or whatever it is. So I don't know, I think if you're developing something and shipping it to people, there's kind of a weird obligation that you know what else is coming along with your application, or else there's a chance that things are going to fall out of sync, and then you're going to have to repair things. And I think that can be frustrating for people, and I think that's why certain solutions, like AppImage, is quite attractive. All in all, I don't think we've seen the end of application distribution problems or questions. You know, I think that this is very much going to continue to be an open debate for quite some time, and it's really interesting to see how the different operating systems and just even just different schools of thoughts within the same operating system are kind of running around all of these issues, because they keep intersecting and then diverging and then intersecting again, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, maybe that's just because modern computing only has a certain number of ways that you can achieve a certain task. You know, like you want something to occur on modern computing, there's only a couple of paths toward that goal. And so you're just bound to intersect or run parallel at some point. But it's kind of interesting to see just how much they do intersect and how much they do run parallel. So I think eventually, I don't know, eventually we'll all figure it out. But I do think that it's something that's going to continue to be an issue for us, because I don't think anyone's really figured it all out yet. Not perfectly. Although, again, app image, really, really close. As frustrating it is to have to redistribute certain things that you know that your user may already have on their system or whatever, app image makes it really nice because you get that fine grain control. But what do I know? I'm just messing around with this stuff anyway. So, yep, that's my listener feedback for this episode. If you didn't get your feedback in before now, I guess you'll just have to wait to hear my response in episode 18 next week. See you there. Always, thank you for listening. My name has been Klaatu. You can reach me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's FSF as in Free Software Foundation, or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. You can find me online at Mastodon. I'm klaatu@mastodon.xyz. I'm also on IRC, of course, irc.freenode.net. My nick is not Klaatu. Message me or find me in the channels Podcast Planet, Slackware, Slacker Media, any of those. The show's website is GNUWorldOrder.info. I'm also on SDF.org as Klaatu and several other places. Thanks for listening.
Slow, that there isn't time for moving objects to register on the phone.